Welcome, Spacers. This week we have Jonathan Cottrell, Director of Technology at Whiteboard. Jonathan's a great, great guy. I actually saw him twice in the span of a few weeks, and he doesn't even live in Austin, Texas. He was speaking at CSS DevConf in Long Beach, California, aboard the Queen Mary, talking about level 4 CSS selectors. And then a few weeks later, I saw him online talking about the theory of using attribute selectors to challenge how we associate styles to our markup. And I also found out that he has an amazing podcast called Developer's Key, which is a short little shows about improving skill sets as a coder, but also overall as a human being. So definitely encourage you to check it out. Before we get started, some show notes. I'll be hosting a virtual conference on December 10th on Perch CMS. And Perch is a lightweight PHP CMS. You can check out more details at perchcmssummit.com. Also, check for links to sites, apps, tools, and so on that are mentioned in this episode at nonbreakingspace.tv. And please be sure to go on iTunes, search for Nonbreaking Space Show in the podcast section, and subscribe so you always get the latest show. And if you wouldn't mind, just give us a review. It helps us get the word out to other people. With that, that's it for now, and enjoy the show. Well, thanks for coming, being part of the show.
I'm glad to be here. I actually, Nonbreaking Space is one of the very first podcasts that I've listened to, or that I listened to when I first kind of got into podcasting, and it was a huge inspiration for me. So,
oh, wow. Okay, cool. Was it like, oh man, this is so bad, I can do better, and then I just go rush?
No, actually, it was the first time that I'd heard a podcast with content that was like, I don't know, inspiring or enlightening, or I'm not sure what the word would be, but it was that I can't remember the name of the gentleman, but it was a guy from MailChimp, and you'll remember the specific episode.
Aaron Walter?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah.
Aaron is such a great guy, and he always does a great job. I mean, he also has a background in teaching college for like 10 years.
Wow.
So yeah. He actually knows how to teach and what to do and what to bring in. And he's one of the nicest people ever.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was a good show. Cool. Well, that's great. I'm glad the show's done something. That's pretty cool. Yeah. So, it's been kind of crazy because actually within 4 weeks, you've been at two of our events at Advice for Humans. I think that's right. So like you were at CSS DevConf.
I was, yeah.
At the Queen Mary. Like, this is interrogation, by the way. This is not a casual interview at all. So, what were you? And then you were at our online event, the SaaS Summit. Which is right there. So what did you think of the CSS DevConf? I just want to see. It was at the Queen Mary. We had it on a boat, on a ship, typically.
Yeah. Well, the most important part of the discussion is going to be the band, obviously.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Band was killer. I mean, just fantastic. The music was incredible. I thought it was a very well-done conference. I thought that the blind submission process was really cool to see the result of that. And it's partially as a result of the community encouraging people, but it's also, you know, Environments for Humans encouraging people to apply to speak at CSS DevConf. And it turned out to be close to 50-50 split, male-female or identified male-female, something close to that, I think, for speaking. And it was just a well-represented conference. I thought that there's quite a few really interesting talks that I was looking forward to all of them, but things that I never would have thought would be interesting to me ended up being interesting to me. In fact, Marcella's talk was my favorite talk of the whole conference.
And this was
the zombie patterns.
Yes, zombie. He had a great presentation from start to finish. He did a great job.
Just very thorough.
Yeah, and also light. You know, like it was technical, but also light and humor. A nice touch. So it was a really great job all the way through. And so,
I actually connected with him on the first night, and he told me he was going to be doing something about, you know, he mentioned IE, like old IE, and I was like, I'm not going to be, you know, that's not going to be relevant to me because I'm lucky enough to work on projects that we don't have to support it. And so, you know, I was like, oh, well, for some people, maybe that'll be, but I sat in the talk and I just really enjoyed it. So,
Cool. I do want to go back to the band part. Like, you like the band. Do you play?
I do. Yeah, I play guitar. In fact, I have my guitars in this room with me. They used to be on this back wall that you're seeing if you're watching the video. I guess, I don't know. Do you post the video at all?
Yeah, we post the video, but we don't really advertise the video as much. But it's really like, I totally stole this idea from Micah, who does the SAS recordings. I forget his name.
Yeah.
SAS Bytes. And he just does his podcasting through Google Hangouts, which is just, so it automatically records the video and audio, which is not going to be the greatest audio, but I find that it's easier for me when I'm trying to get someone who doesn't do podcasting to be interviewed, that and they're not really too technical, but they understand Google Hangout more than they understand the word Skype or you know, somebody else. So that's why I just decided to just do Google Hangouts. But yeah, so if you're watching, so we are on. Long way to go to say that we're actually on YouTube if you want to check it out. But yeah.
Well, so, you aren't going to see my guitars anyway. So if you're listening to it, you're not missing out. I'm not going to bring them out.
Well, this is a long way to say, like, if you want to check out your wall of no guitars, you totally can.
Yeah. No, it's empty back there. Yeah. No, I do play. And in fact, I was really impressed by the band. I'm impressed enough that I ended up going up and talking to them after they finished their set and asking the guitarist, like, you know, can I look at your gear? And he was totally, I mean, he was excited, just as excited as I was to talk about gear. So it was cool. Yeah.
Yeah. That band, they're called, Harbor Party.
Harbor Party. Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I actually looked them up.
Yeah. They're the first vendor, we looked up once we knew we were going to be at the Queen Mary. And we just thought that which never really happens, like and we actually laughed about it at the beginning, was that like we first contacted in February and in October we actually met for the first time in person. It was just like kind of crazy how we had that. It was, you know, like 9 months later, like, oh my gosh, we're actually doing this. And I think they kind of like were in disbelief that we actually held on to this date and for this gig for like 9 months.
Are you sure you're still in?
yeah. But yeah, so because we thought like it'd be great to have a yacht rock party on a ship, and I thought that was kind of humorous.
It was the floating shark and all.
Oh my gosh, yeah. So and then the octopus. We had a balloon octopus on this, and which is funny because like that came about because we have a yacht rock band playing, and if you don't know what yacht rock is, it's just, you know, smooth music from the 70s and 80s that may or may not have a nautical theme, like sailing, like, you know, Christopher Cross. And then, you know,
it's the most general genre that you can imagine, like there's anything can be yacht rock if it's played the right way. That's the easy part of it.
And so we're playing this lake, and Queen Mary's historic. It's technically now, it's not a ship anymore. It's technically a hotel, but it's a registered landmark hotel. And so it's like Art Deco wood from the design from the 1930s. And so I have wood, I think almost original carpet, not the original carpet when it was built, but original carpet when it was done with serving UK during World War II. But so they came back to be a liner, a cruise liner, like after that. So it's like the original carpet from the 50s, 60s almost in some areas.
Yeah.
And and it has like original wood from that, you know, from actually when they went back and refixed it. And so I actually asked them if we could bring in a fog machine or a bulb machine, and they said no.
They said no. Wow.
Yeah. I said, because they would affect
preserve the ship.
Yeah. So I said, can I bring in some balloons? And they said yes. And so, so
it's, you brought every balloon you could find.
Yeah. And so in LA, I like, you know, one of the things we do when we do see the Dev Conference is like, we really play to the strengths of the city. So mm-hmm. in New Orleans, we had a parade during go down Bourbon Street and French Quarter. And, you know, and then,
cool.
And then, so one of the things we want to do is like play, you know, so kind of like play the strengths of LA. Like, there's got to be a company that does, because there's a party every night probably mm-hmm. for all these Hollywood and TV execs
sure.
in LA, right? So there's got to be someone who just focuses on balloon art for parties. And sure enough, it's like Elite Balloons.
That's all they do.
And that's all they do. It's like, and they had like, hey, we do, I said, like, what do you have for nautical theme? And they're like, we have this balloon thing, which I swear it had an octopus about the size of a cubicle, like just the size of a cubicle. And I was like, you know what? I want one of those. We'll just put it in a corner somewhere. And they went to go check out the space. And they came back and they had a sketch. And, you know, we did on-site training, just on-site viewing of the ship for like a day. So we just didn't know, just so we know, we got a feel for what could be happening on that ship. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And it was just like, so I didn't really know how big this octopus was going to be, but I was just like, oh, it looks pretty cool. Like whatever. And so when they installed it, it actually took over. It was a huge 80-foot octopus. I couldn't
believe it. Yeah, it was massive.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so
somebody mentioned that they would, they wanted to take the octopus down to the Lego model of the ship
yeah.
and like put it on the ship as a massive, you know, I can't remember who it was that said that, but like to make some kid's day who walks through and looks at the Lego ship and now there's a huge octopus overtaking the ship. It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause right next to that room is the, they have models, like scale models of Queen Mary in this other room. But then in this other separate room, they have a Lego, the 60, I don't know how big, like 60 foot. No, there's a huge Lego model of the ship, like right next to where we were. And you just wrapped this balloon around us.
Conveniently about the size of the octopus.
Yeah, exactly. It's like release the Kraken.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, anyway, so we can talk about that. But yeah, so it was a great party. And, but yeah. And so one of the things we love about DevConf is that we get a whole bunch of new speakers that we never would have originally, probably found if we didn't do a double blind
mm-hmm.
voting process. And so, and it's awesome. And also kind of bad because I always think I can't to throwing a big party and you don't know who is coming.
Yeah.
Which is true for a conference in general, but just for speakers, you usually know ahead of time how many people are coming, who's coming. But, but yeah, but I was really pleased with the technical nature of all the talks. They're really kind of high level of talks. And so I thought that was pretty good. So
yeah, really, there was a lot of SVG discussion. Mm-hmm. Especially on that first day. And then there was, you know, the discussion about CSS in your inline styles mm-hmm. or taking, you know, doing it with React or web components. And I'm looking over the schedule right now and just to refresh my mind, but just a ton of really great technical talks.
Yeah.
Totally. And the other side of it was that there was a sense of like, people wanting to show each other the cool stuff they were doing, like Chris having his show and tell, Chris Coyer having his show and tell on that last day before the closing keynote was so much fun. Like you have people coming up and showing things that don't really warrant a full presentation necessarily, but the idea is worth, you know, sharing with people.
Right.
And so it's a really cool format for that.
Yeah. I was running around during that time, but that's like one of the places I wanted to check out if I could have, just to see how that vibe was going in that room.
It was super chill. It was like it was like hanging out in somebody's living room. Oh, you know, it was like less stressful than going to like a meetup, like a local meetup. It felt more friendly than even a local meetup. It was cool.
Okay, cool. Awesome. Yeah. That's really cool. But anyway, so I do want to talk about what you're doing. You're talking about level 4 selectors.
Yeah, level 4 selectors. Mine was probably, in terms of technical as it gets, because I quite literally went through the entire level 4 selector spec and basically created a talk around it instead of having to, you know, slog through all of that, all of those wonderful things that make up the spec. And, you know, of course, more respect to the people who spend the time to make that spec. It's all important and necessary, but it's sometimes a little bit hard to access, especially for developers who, you know, aren't spending all their time reading that stuff. They're trying to make stuff, you know, all the time rather. And so, it ended up being relatively short, but I went through every new selector in the spec, and I actually don't know how many new selectors there are now that I think about it, but I covered every new selector. It was my favorites, by the way, if anyone is wondering. Matches is a really, really cool selector.
Well, what does Matches do?
So Matches is a pseudo selector. I want to say pseudo selector. It's not a pseudo element, a pseudo class maybe. Anyway, it basically colon matches, and then you do parentheses, and you can pass in any number of simple selectors inside of Matches or any number of complex selectors inside of Matches. And so if you bundle these two, if you bundle two matches together, then you basically can have what would otherwise require a lot more selector code. It's easier to see this, obviously, but it would require, you know, 10 to 15 lines can be done in one line. It's really powerful. Okay. And it's already available, by the way, in Safari. It's not available in Chrome yet, but it is available in Safari. The has selector is pretty cool. I call it the coffee cabinet selector, because you don't call a coffee cup cabinet, you don't call it a coffee cup cabinet unless it has coffee cups inside of it, right?
Okay.
And so I dubbed it the coffee cup cabinet selector. Unfortunately, it's not going to be fast enough to do it inside of a style sheet, but you will be able to use it in JavaScript. Okay, so basically, it checks for the contents, any descendants of an element. You can check the contents of that element and determine, does it have that inside of it?
And wow. So like, what do you mean by content? Like, what does it check for? Like,
so like, let's say you have a nav, right? Okay. And you want to check for a nav that has a anchor tag with a class of logo. Mm-hmm. You can do nav colon has parentheses a dot logo.
Okay.
And it'll select the nav element, not the anchor tag, but the nav element. Okay. Based on its contents.
Okay, so it's like looking down and saying, okay, this is what you want, but then looks back up.
Yeah, it's like the holy grail of selectors is a lot of people like to call it, because otherwise you still have to do this in JavaScript, because essentially it's not performant enough to do it in a dynamic context.
Right. And then there was also placeholder, is it on the input? Is that right?
Yeah, there's a placeholder shown. Is a name that's another selector. So colon placeholder dash shown. And basically all the times where the placeholder is shown, you can select and style that element based on that.
Oh, nice.
Which is, it's really nice for form styling. And, you know, if you have it focused, for example, or if you have some input in that particular element, right? If the input value is not nil, or empty rather, you can style the input based on whether or not the placeholder is shown, essentially. Yeah. It's exactly what it sounds like.
Cool. And then is there a time one I'm looking at? I'm actually looking at Natalia's sketch notes.
So there is a, time dimensional pseudo classes. Basically what that is, in a future spec, there's going to be, what amounts to closed captioning and transcripts. And as a video or audio is playing, you'll have the transcript that automatically, you know, advances along with that video and audio.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's basically encoded. But at the moment that a particular piece of text is being read, you can style that based on whether or not it's current.
Right.
Obviously, again, this is something that we've been doing with JavaScript.
Right.
Quite a while, but this would allow you to do things like, you know, CSS animate stuff across the bottom of the screen, or you know, whatever you want to do.
Right. Okay.
Pretty powerful accessibility stuff too. Yeah. And speaking of accessibility, the language selector,
yeah,
attribute selector stuff, it used to be that we would only select based on attributes, right? But now the spec allows you to select all elements that actually resolve to a particular language. So you know, typically the language is set on the HTML element, and then we would do a selection, you know, lang equals en or whatever. And then anything inside of that, we would style a particular way. But now we can do colon lang and then pass in a number of different options. One of them being just a base language, but you can also do asterisk for wildcard. So you can do like language namespaces. So if you are a developer for something that has a lot of translation and the translation changes style, this is going to be really, really important for you in the future.
Oh, nice. Okay. Yeah. I can definitely see that. Yeah. I've done a couple of international sites in my time, and they were always painful.
Yeah.
To do change of design and to fit their needs. So
yeah, it's difficult.
But actually rewarding in some ways, because you're actually trying to build a site for the world wide web, and you realize that not everyone speaks English. So, yeah,
that's true.
Yeah. It's and very designed for that. So.
Yeah,
new ideas, guys. That's what we're about here.
Yeah,
not everyone speaks English.
not everyone speaks English. Believe it or not.
It's part of it.
As ubiquitous as it feels.
Yeah, and then valid and invalid seems kind of like yeah. how would this be triggered? Like if you just do a How would that be applied to check to see if the input field is invalid or invalid?
So you can have different attributes set on input, like the required attribute, mm-hmm. and just the existence of required. The input would be considered invalid mm-hmm. unless it had a value.
What if you put it to like I know sometimes you can do like a pattern on yep. input. So would it be able to match that yes. and say like this is invalid or not based off the input?
Okay. Exactly. Yeah.
Oh, nice.
And there's another, there's two other things that are pretty cool about the validity pseudo classes. Mm-hmm. One is that you can do user-invalid.
Okay.
So, and basically what that means is, let's say you have an input that's required, right? But the user is loading that page for the first time and it doesn't have a value. Well, you don't want to show them a style as if they've made an error, right? That's kind of jarring to see an error on a required field that shouldn't be invalid until after you've interacted with it. And that's exactly what user-invalid does.
Okay, so user-invalid is just, it's the initial page load?
So it's basically only applied once the user has interacted with that particular field. So presumably once they've focused it, or maybe once a change event has fired on it.
Okay.
The spec isn't totally clear on that, but okay. Yeah, it just kind of says once they've interacted with it.
Oh, nice. Okay. Well, that sounds crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Which, again, we've done that with JavaScript for years, form validation and that kind of stuff. But now we're getting slightly. And in fact, Chrome won't even submit a form unless, if something is required mm-hmm. and you haven't filled it in, Chrome will actually give its own error pop-up, like a popover. Oh. So if you have an input that's required and you've skipped it and you click submit, Chrome's like the Chrome UI will actually do a little error message and say this input is required.
Oh, wow. Okay. That's pretty awesome.
And the other thing about validity classes, I could go all day.
That's fine. That's awesome.
The validity classes can also be applied to field sets. Mm. So you can check an entire 5 or 6 inputs. I wouldn't recommend putting 20 inputs inside of a field set. You can check a couple of fields all at once. Mm-hmm. So let's say you have a 3-section form for whatever reason. You can check entire sections and then maybe put a checkbox at the header of the section rather than trying to validate each field independently and then doing checkboxes on each field. Gives people a sense of overall progress and that kind of stuff.
Cool. Wow, that's awesome. Cool. Awesome. All right. Well, this is definitely great. A lot of stuff. Let's see. There's Any link, what is that? Any hyphen link, does that mean?
Any link refers to, so links are not just anchor tags. They're also links. I can't remember the exact syntax, but there can be links inside of an SVG. And then okay. It seems like there's one other link that you can have. But in any case, any link, it covers all of those, right? So that includes the visited as well as the non-visited links. So you could you could do like colon any link or asterisk colon any link and then set a color in case you, for whatever reason, don't want your visited links to have a different color from, which you should, by the way. That's a bad idea. But so, let's say you don't want underlines or something like that, right? You could do it on all links at once.
Yeah, but what's the difference between any link and then just saying setting values for just an A element?
So because any link matches anything that has the href, it's basically anything that has the href attribute. Mm-hmm. And that can be a link element. It can be an anchor element. It can be inside of SVG. There's another one. I can't remember again the exact syntax for it, but there's multiple types of links that you can have in HTML.
Okay. So it's way beyond just a link. Okay, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Great. And then, sorry to pick your brain on short notice.
No, I love it.
And then for SAS Summit, you talked about attribute-driven design. What is that about?
This is less technical and more opinionated. So this will spark the debate amongst the listeners, hopefully. So I dug into CSS a few years back. Probably 4 or 5 years ago is when I really got heavy into CSS. And back then, we used IDs all over our CSS. And at some point, someone smart realized that IDs kind of cause problems, right? They cause some overall design issues, not aesthetic design, but code design, code organization, and maintainability issues. And so we collectively decided to ban them from our style sheets, right? Like if you write CSS now and you see an ID, there's probably some red flags that go off, right? And you think, okay, well, how can we move away from the ID and move towards the class? Okay. So the idea of that change kind of sparked in me a question of, you know, are there changes that we should be aware of and concerned with making now? What is the next change that we can make to the way we write CSS? And of course, you know, people solved this question in many different ways. One of those ways was the, you know, inline styles with React. But I started looking into this idea and I found Attribute Module CSS, which was written by Ben Schwartz and Glenn Mattern. Glenn was also at SASConf, by the way.
Oh, wow.
And so I accidentally, funny story, I accidentally ran into him at the opening party and we had like a 10-minute conversation before I even knew who he was.
Oh, wow.
Like before I knew that he was the author of the thing that I was getting ready to give a talk on. It was great. It was probably my favorite moment of that conference. But so I started looking into AMCSS and they outlined some problems with classes that I had never really thought about. Specifically, if you look at the spec for classes and you really kind of look at the intention that was behind classes from the start, basically what it says is that classes are available to use. It says nothing about how you're supposed to use them. It says nothing about, you know, what kind of naming structures. It basically says that classes are like variables. We can name them whatever we want, however we want to name them, and it's totally okay according to the spec. So we've been naming them many different things for many, many years. A lot of CSS architecture discussions are based on how we name our classes. And so many problems can arise if you don't have a good naming structure for your classes. So attribute-driven CSS basically gives you more flexible naming. It gives you more connection between what you're writing in your code and what you're actually doing in the style sheet. So for example, you can have a text-utils attribute. Instead of writing text utilities in your classes, like a u-dash, and having to write documentation about what u-dash means, right? Because you know, somebody coming in could look at u-dash and not understand that it means utility. They might think it means user, for example. Connecting these things semantically is all we're trying to do with all of our CSS architecture anyway. So when we look at our HTML structures and we see 10 or 15 classes on a given element, nobody can walk away from that element knowing what's going to happen, right? It can be a very confusing structure. And because so many people are using classes to do the visual markup, right? So we prototype by adding classes to things. The idea of atomic CSS, where one class adds one property, that is really difficult to reconcile as readable code and walk away from that HTML knowing what's going to happen. So attribute-driven styles allow you to separate those behaviors out from each other. And you can implement something like BEM with less characters and much more understandable code. And if you look at the code, examples and the kind of the AB between class versus attribute module or attribute driven rather, I would say that it's significantly more readable. It's much easier to see the intention. In fact, one of the slides that I had in my presentation had a hidden class at the end of the class string. And it said, "Bet you won't see this," all separated by hyphens. And nobody saw it. Literally no one saw it because we just gloss over these long strings of classes. It is an interesting exploration. And the intention of the talk was to only get people to think about it, not to necessarily convince everyone, you know, attribute driven is the way to go, but instead to be ready to change and be ready to question whether CSS classes are really the only way or the best way to do things.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. So, because one of our examples was to, like, instead of having, classitis, if you will, it was just to, like, use the attributes and you had different comparisons, like between lines of code was one of your examples. And then also clarity. Mm-hmm. It was a big issue with that attribute design. I thought that came across very clear in your presentation about, like, and as you just mentioned. So, but yeah, so cool.
Yeah, I love talking about this stuff and would love to, like, if anybody has questions about it, I jump all over the discussion because I think it's such an interesting topic of discussion. We don't really talk, I tweeted this out the other day. We don't really talk about how code hits our eyes very often, right? We talk about performance a lot. We talk about accessibility. We talk about, structure and architecture. But very few times do we actually talk about, for example, something as simple as changing your highlighting in your editor. This is super important, right? Like seeing your code in a way that's readable to you is fundamental to each and every keystroke. And if you can make your code more readable to humans, then you're going to see, like, cascading effects, no pun intended, that really make a big difference in the long term. Because it's, one little piece at a time becoming more readable, more semantically understandable.
Yeah, I guess it makes sense because, there's programmers and coders, developers, they have their own, after a while, they just start to own their space of their development space. And I've seen this plenty of times when they want to have almost little mini wars over which one's the best color scheme for their text editor. And so it goes to show you that if people, developers are crazy about, not crazy, but are passionate about their color schemes and their code editor, I mean, they should also go to one step further, that how we code should also impact it too. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Make your code actually literally look good.
Yeah.
Right. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, I would say it's a good thing.
Right. And I think that's where, Dan Cederholm, when he was writing books, he actually made sure to, like, hammer home that, handcrafted quality and make sure it's actually, take pride in your work and stuff like that too. So, like a craftsman. So
yeah.
And then I do want to talk about your podcast.
Sure.
Developer Tea. How did that get started, and what made you? So I know you mentioned Unmarked Space, but I don't think that's like the real reason.
Yeah, no, so Developer Tea started in January, so we're pretty close to a year old now, which is kind of crazy. Yeah. And I started sitting right here at this desk, and I had the idea of doing a podcast. I'd wanted to do one for a long time because really the format of Developer Tea is kind of the selling point, right? It's a 10-minute podcast-ish. Sometimes it goes well over that, but typically I try to hit 10 minutes. Sometimes I do less than that. Just depends on the day. But to deliver it, you know, multiple times per week, but at that short, trying to hit that short mark. And the hope being that, you know, people with a short commute or with a small break in their day can kind of keep up, not necessarily with development news, but with, you know, even things like soft topics, right? Talking about hiring, talking about you know, how to deal with burnout, very small, very simple stuff.
I really enjoyed the soft skills episode that you did. That was pretty nice.
Yeah, there's you know, I talk about focus, for example, and I talk about learning and quite a few topics that are not just specific to developers, but they come from a developer's perspective, I guess. I am a developer, so they do come from my perspective, but it certainly is opinion, and I'm very clear about that. And I honestly, the idea was just to try it out and see if I liked it, right? Yeah. I really had no idea that it would be well received or anything like that. I just had decent audio equipment. Yeah. So I, you know, started recording. And that was, I passed the name around. I was going to do Developer Coffee or Developer Coffee Break or something like that. But coffee, quite honestly, is totally saturated on iTunes. There's like 500 coffee break podcasts. So I was like, no, I can't do that. And Developer Tea just kind of had a good ring to it. So
nice. Yeah. I really appreciate the 10 minute or the shorter podcast. I think that's pretty nice.
There's some really good ones too.
That's awesome.
Ruby 5 and I think it's called 5 Minutes of JavaScript. Stuff by the Code School guys.
Oh, nice. I checked that one out.
Yeah, they're good.
Cool. And so, I definitely recommend people check it out. It's pretty awesome. I liked it because I was going through and researching for today, and I really enjoyed it. It was almost like NPR-ish, if you don't mind me saying that. But it was like, it's like, hey, you read something and you're actually talking about and breaking it down.
So it was the way it comes together.
Because I felt like, you know, you tweet out a link sometime, but you don't really, you know, like, hey, I thought this thing is pretty cool. And unless it's self-evident, you know, that what your text is in your link, in your Twitter or tweet or whatever.
Yeah.
Sure. People just won't know grasp what's going on. And then you're at the mercy of the article you just tweeted to, whether they have, you know, it's good writing or not for people to grasp what's going on. But I really like the fact that, you know, the podcast episodes I listened to was just like, oh, he's giving the context and what that means.
Sure. Thank you.
But research. Question we always ask is, how'd you get into web design or development?
Yeah. As we've already talked about, I'm a musician and, I think this actually happens. I'm going to do a study one day when I have nothing else to do, which is probably never. but of people who got into this because they started out as a musician, because I think there's a lot of them. But nevertheless, I was a musician. I still am. But I used to play in bands. And I wanted to have an easy way of reaching people and promoting the work, the music that I was doing. I wanted to do some like studio sessions and stuff. So I wanted to kind of put like a portfolio up, and turns out as a result of that, I got really interested in photography. And so I decided, well, maybe I need to put a photography portfolio up online. So I learned how to put a photography website together and eventually launched that. But in the process of that, I realized that I really enjoyed the process of designing websites. And so I decided that I was going to start a web design blog. It does not exist. Don't go look for it. but this was back in like the 2007 or something around that. So I started a blog and started writing. And then I met some people in the industry, started writing for other blogs. And then I decided to get an internship as a designer. Okay. So I go into my interview and I show them my website and they tell me, we're going to hire you as an intern as a front-end web developer. And I thought, great. Front-end means design. It does not mean design. As it turns out though, I was much more suited to being a front-end developer than I was a designer and really enjoyed the interactive elements of code. That's where I learned all of my JavaScript knowledge. I started there and really just kind of slogged through. I think every developer has that story where they wrote their own slider. And that's how it's kind of like the battlegrounds, proving grounds rather. But yeah, so then I went on to get a master's degree in digital media. And that's really kind of what solidified my interest in computing.
Yeah, it was at Georgia Tech is where you went to, right?
Yes, right. That is correct.
And how that happened? That was that's pretty awesome.
I got my degree in communications advertising, and which doesn't particularly have web necessarily built in, right? Mm-hmm. It's something that they have a web design course in the program that I took. So I had to teach myself this stuff. I actually was into After Effects and video editing. And so there's some JavaScript involved with that. And so I learned enough to be able to create, cool little interactions online, things that slide around the page and stuff like that. And so I was interested. I knew I wanted to be in web development, but I wanted to get a master's degree and I couldn't find a master's degree in web development.
Right.
So I started looking to, see what schools made sense and which schools had. I saw like MIT's Media Lab,
right.
Which if you're not aware of what that is, go now and find out about it because it's super like really cool stuff that they're doing at MIT. But another well-rated program was Georgia Tech. And because I lived in Tennessee and my family lives in Alabama, I decided that Georgia Tech was a good option. So I applied and got accepted.
Okay, cool.
It was a fantastic program.
Yeah, good. Is this, I think it's relatively new. Is that right? Am I thinking about the same program?
It is. In terms of digital media programs, it's probably relatively new. It's okay. Somewhere around, I want to say like 1999 is the earliest.
Okay.
So it's not brand new, but they have definitely put more energy into it in the last probably 5 to 10 years.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Cause I know, I think I was looking at maybe applying to that one myself when I was looking to get a master's degree, but I went to Florida State and got visual communications.
Oh, great. Yeah. I actually work with some people who went to Florida State as well.
Cool. Yeah. And So I know about it. So I know it's, Georgia Tech is always a great school. So it's
sure.
Pretty awesome.
Yeah. It's good to be around a lot of really smart people. That's like, if you go to a master's degree, if you're listening to this podcast right now and you're wondering, should I go get my master's degree?
Yeah.
Perhaps the most compelling reason to go and get a master's degree is the people that you will be around while you are getting your degree, right? That's the whole value, because all this, all the practical knowledge that you'll get in the degree, typically you can find online somewhere and probably for free. Like you can read the same books inside or outside of a degree program. But it's the people that you get to be with and the conversations and the work that you get to look at and watch other people perform. That's really where the value is.
Yeah. You get the community aspect of it and slogging through it together and learning. It's pretty awesome.
It is. And it is unique from learning on the job. It is unique from learning on your own. Certainly. So it's, in many ways, it has the same kind of benefits as going to a conference, quite honestly.
Yeah.
There's nothing that you're going to learn at a conference that you couldn't find somewhere, somehow online in some form, right? Mm-hmm. If you go to a conference, just to go to the presentations, you're missing the point. Go to a conference to meet and enjoy the time with the people that are at that conference. And you get a chance to, you know, talk about the actual stuff that you're building and talk about it with the people who know the most about it.
So after Georgia Tech, what'd you do next?
So there was a couple of buddies that I went to my undergrad degree with, and they, we all kind of started building web projects beforehand and really enjoying it. It was mostly as like side income, and we had done quite a few projects together. When I went to Georgia Tech, they decided that they wanted to start a company, and they started at first as kind of like freelance on the side, and then eventually it became a full-time thing. I was still working with them just kind of in a contract role. They started the company here in Chattanooga. It's called Whiteboard. And they actually basically immediately after my master's degree was over, they sent me an offer. And then I determined, yeah, this looks like the perfect opportunity. So, so now I basically have stayed with that company. And we work, it is agency style work, so we're working for different clients every day. Really interesting work. So I am the director of technology at that company now. And luckily I have the opportunity of working with developers who have we have since hired. And that's the most fulfilling part of the job.
And what is your most, what's your thing that you're looking forward going forward? What are you passionate about these days?
So I'm very interested in learning more about JavaScript. That's kind of the heavy hitter right now for me. JavaScript and functional programming in general. So I do a lot of backend as well. And so I'm interested in code organization. And that's kind of something that I've always appreciated, but learning a little bit about functional programming, I'm learning Elixir. You know, I'm a Rubyist, so I'm learning Elixir because it's kind of parallel in some ways to Ruby. So yeah, that is a really interesting technology to me. JavaScript is interesting because, first of all, there's a lot of energy behind it. There's a lot of people who are building stuff with JavaScript. But secondly, because it's everywhere. JavaScript is on almost every device that you touch now. Maybe not devices from 10 or 15 years ago, but certainly any device that's made today has some kind of JavaScript running on it. So it's a ubiquitous thing. That's kind of ES6, ES2015, whatever you want to call it, the new generation of JavaScript, and then ES2016. There's a lot of stuff that kind of brings JavaScript into the this age, I guess you can say. So it's an exciting time for JavaScript programmers.
Yeah, my joke is that Skynet is written in JavaScript.
Definitely. Yeah. No doubt about it. Probably transpiled. It could be written in CoffeeScript.
Well, first generation probably.
But, yeah.
Cool. Awesome. Well, it's been great talking to you. How can people find you on their internet, on the socials?
Oh, yeah. I'm all over the place. You can find me at Jay Cottrell on Twitter, at DeveloperT, and at SpecFM, actually. Spec is the podcasting network that DeveloperT is a part of. I started it with the hosts of Design Details, if you're familiar with them. And we have a couple of other podcasts on the network, spec.fm, if you want to just look at the network site.
Cool. Awesome. Well, thanks, Jonathan, for being here.
Thank you, Chris. I really enjoyed it. Oh, and of course, whiteboard.is.
Okay.
Whiteboard is, and then at whiteboard is the other one. So thank you. Thank you for inviting me to be on the show.
Definitely, man. Cool. All right, next time.